You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, Updates in the Management of Agitation Associated with Dementia Due to Alzheimer's Disease. In this episode, we discuss the pathophysiology of Alzheimer's disease-related agitation, specifically the role of neurotransmitters in the condition. My name is Deb Gordon, and I'm thrilled to host today's podcast. I'm joined by Dr. Gary Small, who chairs the psychiatry department at Hackensack University Medical Center in New Jersey. Welcome, Dr. Small.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you.
So let's just start with an overview of what is agitation in Alzheimer's disease.
So I think everybody has a sense of what agitation is. It's kind of a heightened emotional state, and it can be manifested by what people say, how they feel, and also by how they behave. So somebody who is agitated may express feelings of anxiety, of restlessness. Physically, you observe them perhaps pacing around, fidgety. They have trouble sitting in place. So it could be a constellation of different symptoms. And in Alzheimer's disease, as cognition progresses, we tend to see more and more agitation accompanying that cognitive decline. And if I can just add, it's important when we see these symptoms to think about what might be causing them, because there's just a lot of different features of the illness that can cause it, not just the progressive cognitive decline, but an individual may move from one residence to a nursing home, or there may be environmental changes, or there could be a medical condition or perceived threats. So it's always important to get to the bottom of it so we can have more effective interventions.
That's very important. And another one of our podcasts in this series for our listeners has to do with assessing and diagnosing agitation. So over the years, our understanding of this condition has evolved. How has it shifted from what we maybe used to think it was to what we know now in terms of being a neurological condition?
In the past, we tended to look at agitation as having some kind of a psychological trigger in general, or some kind of environmental trigger. But now we're learning more and more about the neurobiology, the pathophysiology of Alzheimer's disease, and finding correlations between changes in the brain and the kinds of behaviors that are manifested when we define it as agitation. So we know that as Alzheimer's disease progresses, there are a lot of different changes in the brain. There's a buildup of abnormal protein deposits called amyloid plaques and tau tangles. There's atrophy of the brain tissue that tends to affect certain regions more than others, particularly the medial temporal area, hippocampus, frontal lobe, and other areas. And quite pertinent to what we're seeing with agitation is that there are imbalances of brain messengers or neurotransmitters such as glutamate, acetylcholine, dopamine, and serotonin. And all these changes have been proposed as triggers for the neurobiological basis of these behavioral symptoms in Alzheimer's disease.
Can you talk about key neurotransmitters and what we see in terms of changes and how that affects behavior?
So we know that serotonin is a neurotransmitter. It's a monoamine, and it's derived from the amino acid tryptophan. And it's produced in the brainstem in what we call the raphe nuclei. And serotonin imbalances, we know, occur in many mood problems, but also they've been implicated in experiences of agitation and aggression. You know, because if you look at some of the medicines that have been used to treat these symptoms, another endogenous neurotransmitter is dopamine, which is very important in the manifestation of these symptoms. Glutamate is another one that's quite important. So it's a constellation of changes in these various neurotransmitters that are leading to these problems that we're observing.
How has this understanding changed, or should it change, practice in terms of treating the condition, treating agitation medically?
Well, I think the understanding is helpful, but really, to me, what drives the treatment is the results of clinical trials and clinical experience. You know, we can have a theory that this neurotransmitter, if it's elevated or lowered to abnormal levels, that that's what's causing the problem. That certainly drives drug discovery and our search for new treatments to help. But the bottom line, when it comes to treatment, we may have a great theory as to how something works in the brain. But the bottom line is, what do we know from experience, from randomized placebo-controlled trials, as well as our own clinical experience with patients, that should drive how we make our clinical decisions?
So sort of along those lines, you know, some of the drugs that are often used to treat agitation, I'm thinking of antidepressants and antipsychotics, they do work directly on some of these neurotransmitters. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, what we find in clinical practice, often the guidance is to look in a little more detail at the symptoms that the patient is manifesting. So it may be a patient is experiencing agitation and anxiety, but the underlying cause could be a psychosis. Or as I mentioned earlier, there could be a medical problem or a medication side effect. So for example, if you have a patient who's agitated and there are also symptoms suggesting depression, one might choose a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor as the treatment. Other kinds of medications that are sometimes used would be atypical antipsychotics, especially if somebody is experiencing psychosis. Other medicines that have been used are anticonvulsant medicines that seem to calm patients down. And then even getting into more detail about the side effect profile of these medicines. So let's say you have a patient who's agitated, having trouble sleeping. Doctors have used a sedating antidepressant at times to help them. Now, all these uses are generally off-label because until recently, we haven't had a medication that's been cleared by the FDA to treat agitation in dementia.
So let me back up just a little, looking back at those drugs that you discussed. Obviously, the serotonin reuptake inhibitor is working on the serotonin pathways. Can we connect the class of medications to neurotransmitters so that we are getting even a better understanding of their mechanism of action?
Well, so for example, typical and atypical antipsychotics act on dopamine receptors. We also, you know, antidepressants will act on serotonin receptors and also noradrenergic receptors, depending on the subclass of the medication. And you do tend to see differences in the effects. You know, I mentioned acetylcholine. There's problems in that neurotransmitter system as dementia begins and progresses. And, you know, the medicines used to treat the general symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, the cholinesterase inhibitors, also have been shown to reduce the emergence of neurobehavioral symptoms in patients with dementia. They're not all that effective in treating, you know, more severe symptoms, but clinical trials have shown that these kinds of neurobehavioral symptoms are less likely to emerge when patients are on these symptomatic treatments, such as the cholinesterase inhibitors.
And as you were beginning to talk about, we do have the first FDA-approved drug for agitation and Alzheimer's disease. Can you talk a bit? We're going to go in depth into the clinical trials and such in another episode of this podcast series. But just start briefly, tell us about the drug and tell us about the mechanism of action.
Brexpiprazole, it's actually the only atypical antipsychotic that has FDA approval for agitation associated with dementia if it's due to Alzheimer's disease. It's an atypical antipsychotic. It's in that group of antipsychotics that target the serotonin and dopamine chemical pathways in the brain, which we know are out of whack when Alzheimer's disease strikes. It's a serotonin dopamine activator modulator. That's a lot of syllables, or you can just say SDAM. It's an atypical that selectively binds the catecholamines, norepinephrine and epinephrine. And these are released from sympathetic nerve endings. And it acts as this partial agonist at a serotonin receptor, FHT1A, and a dopamine receptor, D2 receptor. And it's also an antagonist of another serotonin receptor, FHT2A, and an adrenergic receptor, alpha-1A. Now, it has less intrinsic dopamine 2 activity, which means that we would think it would have lower risk of akathisia and extrapyramidal symptoms. It also has higher potency at the FHT1A, and that could result in better anxiolytic effect, perhaps better antidepressant effect, and theoretically could have pro-cognitive effects.
Oh, that's fascinating. So it's quite different from the other atypical antipsychotics then.
You know, if you look at these nuanced differences in effects on various neurotransmitters, yes, there are those differences. But again, that's theoretical. The bottom line is, what do we see in clinical trials?
You want to give us just a very brief overview?
Well, there have been several randomized clinical trials that suggest that this drug, 2 milligrams, may be efficacious, safe, and well tolerated in these patients with agitation in Alzheimer's dementia.
Great. Is there anything I haven't asked you about in terms of the pathophysiology of agitation in Alzheimer's disease that you'd like to share with our listeners?
One thing to keep in mind is that this is a gradual process, that it takes years. And, you know, we're focusing today on agitation, you know, one of the neurobehavioral symptoms we see. But studies that have been done show that there are non-cognitive symptoms that can emerge even years before the diagnosis of dementia is made. You know, everything from social withdrawal to anxiety, and as the disease progresses, you'll see depression, agitation, anxiety, aggressiveness. And these are very difficult behaviors to address. And so it's not just about the biology, it's also about practical strategies to help caregivers manage these very challenging symptoms.
I think that's a really good point, a really good clinical pearl, if you will. We actually are out of time. So I want to thank you so much for this very insightful conversation. And I want to thank our listeners for joining us. And as we've discussed throughout this podcast, we have 4 other episodes to listen to, each focusing on a different aspect of this condition. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide CME for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. And I really want to give a special thank you to our supporters, Otsuka America Pharmaceutical, Inc. and Lundbeck, who provided an educational grant for this activity.